everybody. On Monday night of this week at 9 o'clock New York time, NBC on its Monday Night at the Movies presented something called the UFO Incident, based on the incredible story told by a New Hampshire couple about 15 years ago. You might recall that in 1961, two people, Betty and Barney Hill, claimed that they were taken on board an alien spacecraft, examined by alien beings, and then released unharmed. Understandably, at the time, back in 1961, this story caused a great deal of skepticism, but in the years between 1961 and the present, some startling evidence has been found to indicate that most or all of the story told by the Hills is 100% true. Betty Hill is my guest on the program this morning, and she'll join us in just a couple of minutes. Again, September 19th of 1961, and here is Betty Hill, the lady who supposedly was on board an alien spacecraft, saw humanoids, and had an experience that she will never forget. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me ask you at the beginning. I know that you've done some television programs in the New York area. Your story was the subject of a two-hour movie on Monday night. Why subject yourself to this continual barrage of publicity and questioning?
That's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's not my whole life. It's something that I fit in to my normal life without disrupting it very much.
Do you have any intentions of setting this all down in book form, or have you done that?
There was a book written about my experience. I did not write it. It was written by John Fuller.
Would you ever like to write it all down yourself?
No, not particularly.
Okay. Can we start at the beginning? And I know that the audience is quite familiar with most of the details if they saw the movie on Monday night, but to hear it from you rather than from a scriptwriter, I think might be a little more helpful. What happened?
The experience itself started on September 19th, 1961. My husband Barney and I were returning from a vacation trip. We left Montreal and started down to the White Mountains of New Hampshire. It was on a Tuesday night, and there was almost no traffic on the highway when we suddenly saw what we thought was a new star in the sky. And then it started moving, so we assumed it was a plane. Then it came in towards us, and we realized it was not a plane. We really did not know what it was. It followed us for about 30 miles, and it was following along the contours of the tops of the mountains. When we got in an area called Indian Head, it left the top of the mountain, came out over the highway, stopped in midair. And at that point, Barney decided to get out and to identify this. I knew it was something unconventional, but he was very close-minded. There was no such thing as UFOs. So he took the binoculars, got out of the car, started walking towards it. He saw a group of humanoid-like figures standing behind a double row of windows. And one of them was getting the message to him to stay right there. Don't move. He was going to be all right. He realized that he was going to be captured. The craft started to descend. And there was a red light on each side.
Was it noisy?
Not a sound. And the car started to descend, and that's when he knew he was going to be captured. And he ran back to the car, yelling, "We had to get out of there." We took off down the highway. There was a series of beeping sounds. And then we drove along, and there was a second series of beeping sounds. And we returned home. Now, when we got home, we began to realize that there were things that we couldn't quite understand. Both of us had the feeling of being sort of contaminated. We both showered and things like that.
You just felt that you didn't feel quite right.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like I want to take a shower or something right. Like that. I know the feeling. Yeah.
And the tops of his shoes were scuffed. Our watches had stopped functioning. And there were things that we really couldn't describe. We had strange feelings about them. And then I had started having a series of nightmares, and gradually, in trying to check this out, we began to realize that there was a time period missing of approximately 2 hours that we couldn't account for. But we really didn't know what to do about it. Then Barney developed an ulcer, and this was about 2 or 3 years later. and wouldn't heal. So his doctor thought that possibly he ought to talk with a psychiatrist who was in the same building to see if it might be emotional. So Manny started going to Dr. Stevens, and in the process of doing this, he started telling Dr. Stevens about this sighting that we had had. So Dr. Stevens referred Barney and me both to Dr. Benjamin Simon in Boston, an excellent psychiatrist who used hypnosis.
Before we get into that part, let me go back to the time when you were in the car and you observed this craft, whatever it might be, following you down 30 miles of road.
Okay.
Were you scared?
No, not at that point.
Had you ever seen anything like it before?
No.
You say that your late husband had a closed mind at that time on UFOs or flying saucers, that he said there could be no such thing. How did you feel about it?
I had no opinion. I had heard the term. I had no idea how one maneuvered or its appearance. Nothing like that, just the term.
When you say that the humanoids somehow communicated with your husband that he was about to be captured or abducted, did they speak in words? English?
We don't think so, because they were above him in the craft. He was on the ground. And we questioned very much if he'd been able to hear voices. So we don't know how, but he got the message that he was to stay there.
After it was all over, and after you had gone home and noticed the time frame out of whack and had the feeling of contamination or uncomfortability, did you think that maybe you were losing the handle on reality just a little bit?
Nope.
You never had any feelings like, maybe I've got something going on up here that shouldn't be going on up there?
No. We knew we'd seen something, and we were very puzzled and had a great deal of curiosity about what we had seen. I think the time that I really became upset, and this was the next day, when I went out and started looking the car over and found on the trunk that there was a series of highly polished spots. And that was upsetting, and a physicist told my sister to have me take a compass and to check it out to see how the compass would react. And when it reacted erratically, then I began to become frightened.
I know that I'm getting way ahead of the chronology, but I do you ever wonder where those humanoids are?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. I don't.
Really? Do you not? I think that if that had happened to me, I would wish to see them again. And I would wonder where they were and what they were doing and what they took away from me or from you in this case in terms of whatever reason they confronted you, what they learned from you, about the planet or whatever. And you don't think about that at all.
No, I think that their picking us up was just a chance encounter. I think we just happened to be convenient. And if they're really studying people, I would assume they would be busy collecting other specimens.
Does it surprise you that we've not heard of any collecting since 1961?
You mean other people being abducted?
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, stop and theorize about, hey, they're here to study people. Why would they study, why would they not study more than Barney and Betty Hill?
I believe they have. I believe that there's quite a few people who have been abducted.
May I ask you a tough one to ask? Prior to 1961, were you or your husband ever under any kind of psychiatric examination, psychiatric care, anything like that?
No.
So up until 1961, you had lived a comparatively normal life, and you hadn't been to a mental hospital or electric shock treatment or anything like that.
No.
You know what I'm trying to... People, myself included, have the feeling of this one that's going on now, the two that call themselves he and she, that supposedly are advocating for people to sell their possessions and let's take a flying saucer ride to another planet. And I think to myself, that sounds a little crazy.
I'll agree with you.
In other words, you've not been contacted to sell the farm, as it were, and go for the ride to another planet.
No. And if I was invited, I'd refuse.
You would refuse.
Right.
So would I. If they offer me there or there, I'll stay right here for now. How did you finally find out that you had been taken for a ride on a spaceship, as it were?
All right, Barney's ulcer, started going to Dr. Stevens and then referred to Dr. Benjamin Simon. Well, we went in every Saturday morning for 2 hours for 7 months. We were hypnotized individually. And he tape recorded the sessions, and he caused us to have amnesia at the end of each session so that we could not know what we were saying until he had collected all the tapes. Then he played them back to us. And this is when we relived the experience of leaving Route 3, going off into a side road, onto a dirt road. The occupants of the craft were in the road. They stopped us. They came up, took us out of the car, dragged us through the woods, took us on board the craft, gave us a physical examination. They took Barney into one room, and I was taken into a second room. And the,
Would this physical examination be of a type that most of us have experienced in a doctor's office on a regular or irregular basis, a standard physical examination?
It would not have been standard in 1961, because some of the testing that I received, we did not do then. However, we are now doing it.
Examples.
All right. One of the things they did is they inserted a needle-like instrument in my navel, and they told me it was for a pregnancy test. And at that time, this was completely unheard of. Today, we do it.
Did it hurt?
Yes, which surprised them, because they didn't expect that it would hurt. And I guess there is a way of our doctors have of doing it where there is no pain associated with it.
In the time between, you have drawn what is referred to as a star map, which has been looked at by astrologists and astronomers. And before we get into that, let's take a little break, and we will have Mr. Friedman come out, because I think he has some familiarity with it and can give us some comparative or some comparisons between what you have drawn and what is actually in the heavens. Fair enough? Fair enough. We'll be right back after these announcements. Betty Hill and yours truly now is Stanton Friedman, a well-known nuclear physicist who has over 14 years of experience in the development of advanced nuclear and space systems in his experience. He is the only space scientist we have heard of in this country who is known to be devoting full time to ufology or UFOlogy. And he is convinced after spending 17 years studying the subject that flying saucers are real. And I'm told I have your permission to refer to you as the flying saucer physicist.
The galloping gourmet.
Now on to the star map. What is that?
All right. When I was on board the craft, I asked the leader where he was from. He showed me the star map and asked if I knew where we were on the map, which I did not. So he said there was no way he could explain it to me. Then during the hypnosis, Dr. Simon suggested that if I wanted to, and if I could, if I remembered, I could do the star map. So I drew this.
That was as a post-hypnotic suggestion.
Yes.
Which helps in the accuracy, which is the important point here.
Do we have a picture of that star map or a slide of that star map or anything?
There's an article about it that I just happen to have with me.
Yeah.
There were some slides. I'm not sure they'd show up on television. It's a collection of about 15 points joined by lines, which were supposedly trade routes or occasional expeditions. In other words, it wasn't a whole mess of stars. It wasn't 500 little points. It were points of light, apparently a three-dimensional hologram or something like that. And the problem with the star map that Betty drew is there are no labels on the map. I mean, we've got 200 billion or so stars in our galaxy, and here we've got 15 stars.
Is this the one on the top, the interpretation that if you just look at the screen right there, I'm pointing to it? Hill map, right?
Yeah, the hill map is what Betty drew. The other one is a result of an enormous amount of work.
That's the second one.
Yes, that was done. That one was done by computer. But a gal who was then in Ohio, Marjorie Fish, read the story, saw the star map, and said, well, maybe we can check that. And there are no labels on the map. Where do you start is kind of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
She did something nobody else had ever done, this gal. She built a total of 19 different three-dimensional models with all the stars in our galactic neighborhood. Some of them had only certain kinds of stars, some had all the stars, within 30, 40, 50 light years. And the whole point being to look to see if there was any pattern that matched at all with what Betty had drawn on a two-dimensional map.
In the known galactic system.
Yeah, in our neighborhood.
All right.
Real nearby. You see, you can't build a map like this without having distance data, and we don't have distance data on the stars beyond roughly 50, 60 years, light years. after an enormous amount of work, very careful, very well detailed, and reported in this article, among other places, she was able to identify all the 15 stars of the map. And one was the sun, which was very nice, and here it's nice that we're on the map. Several intriguing things about the identifications of the stars. All the stars in the map are the kinds of stars that we expect to have planets and life. That's only true of about 5% of the stars in the neighborhood, for reasons of temperature, age, the rotation rate, technical reasons. Every one of the stars in the map are the right kind of stars, and all the right kind of stars in the neighborhood are part of the map. Now, the chances that out of 250 stars within the volume of space that she was working, that she would grab 15 and come up with only the right kind
are astronomical,
yes,
to use a phrase.
Right. And there was a couple of other intriguing things. The map made sense on a three-dimensional basis. It was going from star to nearest star, rather than going across in a longer path. It could not have been drawn by any Earthling doing the same thing that Marjorie had done prior to Betty's experience. Betty drew it in 1964.
Yes.
Marjorie's work was after 1969 that she was able to identify all the stars. The data on three of the stars, the distance data, was either wrong or non-existent, and non-existent back when Betty had drawn it. There's no way somebody could have done the same thing, programmed Betty, to spit it out that way, because mm-hmm. it would have come out differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which would seem to indicate, since the map is what things look like from out there, away from our solar system, and since none of us have been away from the solar system, that the source of the information would seem to have been somebody who had been an extraterrestrial. Now, the map work also tells us the names of the base stars, where these guys apparently came from. That doesn't mean everybody comes from the same place or anything like that, only this particular crew. And that's kind of exciting, too, because the two stars, or two that are close together, have lots of lines indicating lots of trade routes, as opposed to all the other places on the map. These two stars, Zeta 1 Reticuli, the Greek letter, and don't blame me for the names of stars, I didn't invent the system.
No, and I love the way you've got this all organized. I mean, the guys from Zeta 1 Reticuli, or whatever it is, I think
yeah.
that's great.
There are two stars in the constellation of Reticulum, which you can only see from the southern hemisphere, so you can't go out tonight and go look at them. These two stars, as it happens, and this wasn't known before this was done, these two stars are the closest to each other pair of stars suitable for planets and life in our whole neighborhood. In other words, the nearest star to the sun, we're out in the boonies here, the nearest star is about 5 light years away. These two stars are only a 20th of a light year apart. They're 100 times closer to each other. So we can't even see the smoke from the next guy's chimney, and they've got next door neighbors.
Right.
And nobody knew that beforehand. Now, from a planet around one star looking at the other of these two, you could see it during the day. It would be 100 times brighter than Venus, which is the brightest thing in the sky beside the sun and the moon. With a good telescope, you could see planets around the other star, and we have no hope of doing that from down here. It would be perfectly natural that the earliest interstellar communication and travel would take place when you had a very close neighbor, 3 light weeks away, roughly, as opposed to 5 light years. And these two stars aren't on any of the lists put out by the exobiologists and radio astronomers who are saying we should listen for signals from outer space, probably because they're below the equator, and we smart guys are north of the equator, and the radio telescopes are north of the equator. That information wasn't known before all this work was done.
We were at that big radio telescope at Arecibo.
Yeah. Would
they be able to track these at all?
No.
No.
Below the horizon for
mm-hmm.
them, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so these two stars, incidentally, I should point out, are only 37 light years away.
Does this mean that if we were to build some kind of a listening facility, radio telescope, on the other side of the equator, we might be able to perceive some kinds of signals from these?
If they're sending some, I frankly don't think that
anybody out there... Well, if they're coming down here to pick up Betty and Barney, they got to be sending something.
Oh, but there's no reason to assume that they're stuck with radio. I hate to say that, but no reason to assume that that's the latest means of communication
but
from out there.
If it is within the realm of possibility, Stan, that by constructing a facility that would be able to listen to these two terrestrial bodies,
I mean, extraterrestrial
bodies, wouldn't this be an enormously exciting thing
to
go ahead and do? I mean, why are we not doing this?
Less money, I guess.
Well, let's cancel the war.
There's another reason. You see, radio astronomers are, in general, opposed to the notion of flying saucers coming here. There's one obvious reason and some not-so-obvious ones. One of them is that, obviously, you don't need a radio telescope to communicate if they're landing in somebody's backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Who needs a $10 billion facility? It's been proposed that we build Project Cyclops, 10-mile-wide array of radio telescopes. And you don't need it if they're coming down here. So it would be very nice, and there have been some requests made, that more data about these two unimportant stars. They're not exciting. They're not pulsars. They're not exploding galaxies.
But let's gather something.
Yeah. We don't have much data on them. We have very little spectra data even.
Betty, when you drew this map, did you know at the time... See, I don't know how it feels to be under hypnosis and to receive a suggestion and follow through on it. Did you know at the time what you were doing? Could you see it right in your mind's eye, as it were?
Yes. I mean, I could picture the map that the leader had shown me, and then I just sat there without thinking and tried to read the line.
The way police departments are using this technique now to get police officers to remember license plates, you know, when their buddy was shot and they were thinking about other things. Hypnosis is a standard technique.
But at some point they flashed on that and retained it somewhere in the memory.
Yeah, apparently you've got a videotape machine in the head that grabs on everything that you're exposed to, but getting it back, rape victims. They hypnotize them, have them play it back on a television screen, and then get rid of the emotional problem.
Right.
And they can remember the details.
Remove the trauma and roll the tape.
Roll the tape.
Exactly. What did these humanoids appear like? Anything like life on Earth, people?
The description, they were...
And I think we have a picture of them, do we not?
A drawing.
A drawing.
There's a drawing.
Now, that's a drawing. We should stress now, Betty, that wasn't something you drew.
No.
And it wasn't something that an artist decided, hey, what do extraterrestrials look like? I'll draw one. This was drawn by an artist in New Hampshire, David Baker, sitting next to Barney. While Barney, under hypnosis, describes what they look like. Just like a police artist working with the victim of a kidnapping. And humanoid, I take it to mean two arms, two legs, a head, and a body. You know, you notice there aren't three eyes there. You notice that there aren't four legs. It's not a cross between a giraffe and an octopus.
Can you put it back up? It's a side view. I wish that we had
We do have a frontal view. I think there's another one.
Oh,
this is a bust done by a sculptress working from a whole bunch of those drawings like the one we just saw.
Do you recall now how they were dressed, if they were?
Yes, they were all dressed alike in dark clothing. It was sort of like a one-piece outfit.
Was it a fabric or a metal?
Yes, I would say it was a fabric, that color. No buttons, insignias, or anything like
that. No zippers?
No zippers that I saw.
Like a jumpsuit, kind of sounds like.
Yeah, something like that. And then the leader was wearing a military cap, much as our military was wearing, had a jacket over his. And they were about 4.5 to 5 feet tall. And they had a gray complexion.
And
very large wraparound eyes. Very large eyes.
Big eyes.
Yeah.
Did they in any way threaten you or intimidate you or make it seem as if they were going to cause you harm?
No. And in fact, the leader made an attempt to reassure me. But, you know, I was reacting. I was being kidnapped. You know, and I was having a normal reaction that a person would have in that kind of situation.
So there was some sort of reassurance to quiet. Yeah. It wasn't a vodka martini or anything like that.
No, we kept us saying that.
But they were kind to dumb animals. Yeah. The way specimen gatherers are.
All right, let me stop for a couple of minutes. We'll be right back after these announcements, and I hope you'll all stay with us. We can hear now with Stan and Betty, and I want to spend just a few minutes here asking you about your life and what it's been like since this happened. Your friends, your neighbors, your acquaintances, what do they all make of this?
Well, of course, in the beginning, we didn't tell anyone.
Right.
And for a long time, they didn't know this. And then I think that when it did become known to them, they more or less sympathized with us.
How much feeling did you hear about or sample firsthand where people may have thought that old Betty and old Barney have just, you know, gone over the hill?
Well, I think,
tripped out. The pilot light is gone. You know?
I think, actually, Barney and I lived in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and we were quite well known. I'm a social worker. I work for the state of New Hampshire.
To this day?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've been a social worker for 18 years. Barney worked for the post office, but he was very, very active in community affairs. He was the chairman of the board of directors of the anti-poverty program. He was on the state board of that program. He was New Hampshire Commission of U.S. Civil Rights, many organizations like that. I was on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union. So we were known throughout the state.
You were, in every sense of the word, solid, upstanding citizens of the state of New Hampshire.
Right.
And you continue thus to this day. You are employed by the state of New Hampshire as a social worker. And from talking to you, there are no lingering after effects of this at all. What do you think, in the grand scheme of things, it all means? I'm asking you to be very, very philosophical here. What do you think it all means? Are you a religious person? You believe in...
I'm a Unitarian. I really don't know. This is really saying, what is their purpose? Why are they here? And at this point, it seems to me that they're here to examine us, maybe do an in-depth sociological study, find out how we live, things like this. But the purpose of it, I wouldn't even begin to speculate.
What if you were to see them again?
I'd run.
Why?
Well, somebody else would have a chance.
Incidentally, a lot of other people are getting their turn. I was just at a conference this past weekend in Fort Smith, Arkansas, where the four major UFO groups in the country got together, and there are at least a dozen other time regression apparent abduction cases being investigated at this time. There are hundreds of other reports of Earthlings having seen critters associated with UFOs. And I use critter because I don't know what else to call them, humanoids. If I say LGM, little green men, that's got the wrong tinge to it. So there are, have apparently been lots of other specimens picked up. You know, it's kind of interesting to speculate. What are the chances of having an experience like this and winding up with somebody like Dr. Simon, that is a psychiatrist who uses regressive hypnosis, who doesn't immediately say, hey, these people really went off on a trip someplace, the wrong kind of trip. Most people don't go to psychiatrists, and most people who have had such an experience don't pursue it far enough to know that they've had a time lapse. There's a real problem there, but in terms of the uniqueness of the experience, it's the best documented such case. But there are loads and loads of reports from all over the world, and I want to stress the all over the world part, of people who have seen critters associated with UFOs.
And I'd like to add that this is another sort of a sideline. I think that because of my experience, I receive a great many reports of UFO sightings, landings, and occupants. I collect these and I send them along to APRO in Tucson, Arizona, so that they can...
People know that Betty isn't going to laugh.
Have you seen any objects since September of 61?
No.
Not a single
I've seen strange lights go across the sky, but I wouldn't call that.
I see very weird things every night.
But,
out the window.
This wasn't...
When you live in New York, what do you expect?
Oh, my heavens.
No. I haven't, but I have talked with many people who have.
You know what I can't understand about your bets? If I had seen this thing, I would spend the rest of my life wondering why I hadn't seen it again or when I could see it again. It's like the people who are searching for Noah's Ark or that sort of thing. That once you have this kind of an experience, I would just say, why don't they come back? Because now I know.
Remember, that was Dr. Simon's rule, too, to take away some of the immediacy and the fear and all those other things.
Right, but now, remember, when I was on board the craft, I wasn't able to answer the questions I was asked. And I was very upset about this because I didn't want this leader to judge everyone on this planet by my lack of knowledge. So I invited them back. And I said, if you come back, I'll put you in touch with the right people.
Always wondered
well,
what.
I don't have to look. If he's going to come back, you'll get in touch.
Well, he's not been very polite so far, has he?
No.
All right. I'm going to stop for 2:05. We'll be right back. We're going to get back into a little technological data now, which has not been revealed on national television before.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like a muckraker. I want to sound like a physicist. But,
well, before you go ahead, then let me ask you, how did you get mixed up in all this? Why are you the flying saucer physicist? How many have you seen?
I've never seen any. But look, I spent 14 years chasing neutrons and gamma rays in industry. I never saw one of them either, and I think they're real, too. I read a book 17 years ago, and I was a skeptic, and the book intrigued me. I've only worked on far-out things. Nuclear airplanes, nuclear rockets, fusion rockets, nuclear power plants for space, more canceled programs than anybody else I know.
You are a conceptualizer.
Well, a data analyst, all kinds of goodies thrown into one, I guess. But I read a book. It didn't convince me. I read 15 more books. They were more convincing, and it was Air Force data that finally convinced me. I really didn't do anything about it for the next 8 or 9 years after that. I gave my first lecture about 8 years ago. I found it a lot of interest. I was still working in industry. The last 5 years, after the nuclear aerospace business went down the tubes, as you might expect, and after I got tired of working on programs that wound up being canceled after 2 or 3 years, where you got nothing to show for it.
You know, our businesses have a remarkable similarity in certain areas, don't they? The old cancellation clause there, yeah.
I've had many fewer lectures canceled than I had technical programs canceled. So I found that there's enormous interest in the subject and that I enjoy being on the stage. and that the response at the college campuses is just great. 45 states now and over 300 colleges. I've got my finger on the pulse, I think.
How do you feel about he and she, as they're called, leading us all to to nirvana?
Well, I think it typifies the press's complete unwillingness to come to grips with the whole UFO subject. I mean, there have been religious groups with this UFO tinge running around for at least 25 years. It didn't deserve the attention it got. There's nothing new about it. There are groups that stand on mountaintops waiting for the world to end. There are satanic churches and witchcraft cults. Cultism is all over the place. And there's so much solid stuff going on about flying saucers. That cosmic Watergate that's being treated like Alice's Tea Party.
But you see, the problem with covering that sort of thing from a journalistic standpoint...
You need knowledge.
You need knowledge, and there are so many little stories that get in the way of really finding out truth. Example... the fellow who claimed that there were beings from outer space killing livestock in the Middle West.
Yeah, so much malarkey.
Yeah, the fellow in Wisconsin who had 14 million little men and women in bushel baskets in his basement who were going to take he and his wife away after Christmas to the end of the world. And I remember talking to her saying, what are you going to do the day after the world? And she says, I got an appointment at the hairdresser. And so you say, you know, these people are all wacko because you hear
well,
so much.
That's why guys like me are standing up in public to be counted. And that's why I focus on the data, the facts that are checkable, the ones anybody else can find out about if they want. And you see, there isn't a deluge of data. But I check at all my lectures, and I cover five large-scale scientific studies, and I ask, and no more than 1 or 2% have read any of these, even when I'm talking to 1,000 engineers and scientists at once. So that's why I try to focus on data, and maybe that's a good cue for getting into... Here's the biggest study that's ever been done on UFOs.
Yes, sir.
It was completed 20 years ago. Project Blue Book, Special Report Number 14. Now, this was done by a very respectable firm, Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. They developed the Xerox process as an example. They were under contract to Project Blue Book. The document itself was never publicly distributed. Instead, a totally misleading press release was put out with a statement by the Secretary of the Air Force that on the basis of this study, we believe that no such objects as those popularly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more data had been available. That was a quote. That statement's been repeated innumerable times. There have been editorials. The Los Angeles Times had a big editorial quoting that statement. The only thing wrong with the statement is it's totally false. What I'd like, one of the slides we have reviews the data. There were 2,199 sightings categorized here as something or other.
Here are the slides.
Okay. You can see the six categories on the left, astronomical, aircraft, balloons, other is miscellaneous, includes all kinds of stuff. The ones I'm interested in are the unknowns. Most UFO sightings can be explained. I couldn't care less about them. There were 434 unknowns. If you divide by 2,199, and you can almost see the number on the right next to the unknowns, you find that 19.7% were actually listed as unknowns. Completely separate from that last category that was on the slide, insufficient information. Secretary of the Air Force said 3%. It was 19.7%. He said they were just the ones for which there wasn't enough data. That was not the case at all. There was a quality evaluation done in this sighting, which is what's on the next slide. Same 2,199 sightings, and you can't see the critical data.
To define quality?
Depending on the background of the observer, the circumstance of the sighting, the duration of observation. I mean, presumably a report from a physicist and a pilot of something seen for half an hour in broad daylight at 50 yards would be better than a light zipping by in the sky as reported by the town drunk. Subjective evaluation, obviously.
Right. But, you know, if they want to communicate, you'd think they'd pick us instead of some guy living in a swamp.
Of the excellent sightings, one found that one-third couldn't be identified. The better the quality of the sighting, the more likely it was to be an unknown. And yet the skeptics will tell you, Dr. Carl Sagan has said from Cornell, that there are no reliable sightings that are interesting and no interesting sightings that are reliable. The fact is just the reverse of that. They did a cross-comparison in this study. Unknowns, the ones I'm interested in, versus knowns. Six different characteristics, things like apparent size, color, shape, speed, that sort of thing. They found chi-square statistical analysis for those who worry about such things. They found the probability that the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. The two groups simply do not match in any significant characteristic. And maneuverability wasn't one of the things that was looked at in the study, which is certainly one of the most distinguishing characteristics. Nobody talks about that study. Other data that I'd like to mention, the University of Colorado study, people refer to the Condon Report. World-famous physicist Ed Condon at the University of Colorado spent $500,000 doing a study of UFOs. January 69, all the publicity came out, big book, 965 pages. Nothing of flying saucers. Forget flying saucers. It was all based on Dr. Condon's summary and conclusion. If you look at the data in the report, 30% of the sightings they looked at couldn't be explained, including sightings by orbiting astronauts, including radar visual cases, multiple witness cases. Another source of data very recent.
No, wait, shut off the data for a second.
I'm a physicist. Data's my beat.
I understand, but commercials are my bag. We'll be right back after these announcements. Joining us now is Lee Spiegel, who is the creator of the National UFO News Information Network, a title which he stole from the National Broadcasting Company's News Information Service. This is an intermediate news network that gathers, evaluates, and transmits information about UFOs among radio news reporters throughout the country. And now this gets into the question that you were saying about the press or media attention to UFOs and to sightings. What do you guys do?
Well, there hasn't been enough real credible coverage of UFO sightings because of all the bad kind of reports that came out of the really early 50s, you know, getting back to the old 1950 science fiction type of horror films that we came, it gave a really bad impression in the minds of most of the media. And now, finally, there is an organization which we call NUFNN. And
wow.
I know. And what we do, what the organization itself does, is that it's comprised totally of news broadcasters all around the country and in Canada who are finally offering a serious approach to the coverage of UFO-related news stories. And what it does, in essence, is that...
Have we subscribed to your service yet here?
NBC is about to, yes, NBC Radio AM. We have a mother station here in New York, I won't give the name of it, but in every major city in the country there is a station. So what happens is that when a sighting occurs in a local town or small towns, big cities or whatever, it's up to the individual stations that are involved with the network whether or not they want to get local coverage, national coverage, or whatever. And they do this by deciding through the news directors, through their own reporters, and through using the representatives of the large UFO organizations in America in deciding whether or not the sightings, in fact, are real or are phonies. I mean, you get a lot of stories. Like in 73, during the big flap in the South, there was one story that came out that made a lot of headlines. 50 or 60 people in a small southern town saw a UFO and it made headlines, but it turns out that it was a funny type of UFO because it said UFO on it.
Right, that's got headlines.
Sure. You know, and those are the kind of things that we don't need. And so what the organization does is that it sets a precedent. It's bringing newsmen together finally to cover this UFO phenomenon with
and to afford some responsibility to the information that is passed along to people.
Yes, and in addition to...
Now, when did you see your first UFO?
Back in April of 1975.
You've seen one, huh?
Only one, and I didn't get a very close look at it. I was sent down to North Carolina by Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Surely, he's been a guest on our program.
The Center for UFO Studies sent me down there to investigate a wave of sightings that broke out over a 4 or 5 day period. Between 50 and 60 law enforcement officers were reporting a strange object in the skies that couldn't be explained away by normal terms. And I went down there, got total cooperation from the FAA. They were baffled. They couldn't figure out what was going on. They had nothing on radar. I mean, this craft was doing 90-degree angle turns over officers' heads. It was shining rays of spotlight down on top of officers and engulfing them in their cars and just huge lights. And a lot of witnesses involved, too many law enforcement officers. And this is all around the world. We have the key factor that maintains the people's interest is credibility. Because we get authentic sightings from pilots, radar operators.
So basically what you do is you sift out all the ding-a-lings and midget men in bushel baskets and basements so that does not become a factor in the public consciousness.
Right. And if it does turn out that a case that is being looked into turns out to be a phony case, then we want to talk about that,
you
too.
You put that on the record
as
well.
You have to. In the case of Mrs. Betty Hill here, something that was not known until a while ago, her case took place in 1961. 9 years later, in 1970, the Air Force finally released confirmation that the night that the Hills were driving through the White Mountains, radar picked up a UFO landing in the White Mountains area at precisely the same moment that they were driving along, and later, radar also tracked the UFO taking off.
There was nothing interesting done by the Air Force, incidentally, about that case.
You would think that when the story of Mrs. Hill first
came
to light, that this would have been a banner headline, at least in a small newspaper somewhere in the world.
Look, there have been three PhD theses done on UFOs. One of them dealt with press coverage. And one of the points it made, that there was a failure to follow up on cases to distinguish between the sense and the nonsense. It's an isolated event, every one.
Why do you think it is that there is a rash of sightings, that the, when there's, for example, the Pascagoula, Mississippi, and all of a sudden they were all over the place? Is it?
That's a misperception, Tom. What we're dealing with is the difference between...
Notice how I said seems.
Yes. A lot of people have that impression. That rash of sightings began actually 6 weeks before the Pascagoula case. I know, I was on the radio and on the phone talking to police officers in Georgia. What varies is not so much the number of sightings per month or per year or something like that, but the press coverage of those sightings. Once the wire service picks up a sighting and suddenly everybody around the country knows somebody's seeing UFOs, they're not the first. If they see one, they can stand up and be counted, and especially if it was respectable people. It takes away from the onus. One of my goals is to lift the laughter curtain, and appropriate press coverage helps do that. But let's get rid of a couple of myths, too, about who sees you at
all, right?
The dingling nonsense, you know, that you always hear. The Gallup poll of November 1973.
Incidentally, let me just say, what do I have, three minutes? And I know you have some more data, so
okay, this is part of the data that
all right.
The Gallup poll of November 1973 not only showed that a majority of adult Americans believe in UFOs, but showed that the greater the education of the individual, the more likely to believe in UFOs, which again is the reverse of what the skeptics say. A poll of engineers and scientists showed that a majority of them believe in UFOs. Both polls checked to see how many people had seen UFOs. Again, the greater the education, the more likely to have seen one as well as believe in one. Of the engineers and scientists, 8% think they've definitely seen one, with another 14% saying maybe. And I should stress, this is a worldwide phenomenon. This document of data, and I'll just mention it, covers more than 830 landing trace cases from 39 countries. Cases where UFOs have been seen on or near the ground, and when they leave, one finds physical changes in the soil and the vegetation. About a quarter of those cases involve reports of critters. We're talking 39 countries. So out of context, things look a lot stranger than they do in context. If somebody had reported the Pascagoula cases, close encounter number 835, creature report number 219, abduction number 18, it would have been on the back page of the paper.
In 1 minute, why should we care or worry about flying saucers?
Pragmatic reasons. We're spending a lot of billions of dollars to develop better propulsion systems. B-1. Space shuttle, none of these are competing with UFOs, so if we say it's okay, we should be spending it to find out how these things work. We're spending a lot of money looking for life in outer space. The Viking program cost $1 billion. Let's find out who's coming here. Perhaps the most important thing is it gives us a new view of our own place in the universe. Makes us a little less important than we'd like to think we are, that old ego bit again. And perhaps offers the only hope for a future for mankind if we start to think of ourselves as Earthlings. Maybe our initial allegiance will be to the planet instead of individual countries waving atomic bombs at each other. As a nuclear physicist, bombs scare the heck out of me.
Tom, people are really trying to accept this UFO thing because more people are seeing them on a global scale. And you just can't get away from it when people see things and they report them, and especially the people who see them and don't report them, who want to come out and talk about these things, but we have a ridicule aspect that we have to deal with here.
And your organization is hopefully trying to stop that.
Absolutely.
Gentlemen, I thank you so much for sharing your time with us. Betty, thank you for your candid answers and tough questions. We'll continue after these announcements and tell you about tomorrow night's program.